Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm so happy to be sitting across from Kathleen Shine, who is the author of The New Yorkers and The Love Letter, among other novels. She has contributed to The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, The New York Times Magazine, and The New York Times Book Review. Lots of New York stuff. So I'm glad you're back in New York.
Me too.
And her latest novel is The Grammarians. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
I'm so excited. Tell me what got you into the idea of writing a novel about twins?
Well, as always, that's not where it started.
Yeah.
We're sort of back into it.
Okay.
Especially with twins, because they're so complicated. I'm not a twin. I don't even know twins well. It all started when I one day had this epiphany that I would write a book about translation,
right,
about two people having an argument about two people who are translators arguing passionately and ultimately having a huge feud about mm-hmm. how to translate something. And I wanted them to be very close. I wasn't sure if they would be a married couple or a couple at all, or a father and a daughter and or son or something. I just wasn't sure what the relationship was, but that was the idea. Then, as with many of my epiphanies, I thought, this epiphany stinks because I only speak English. So how am I going to do this? And then Janet, to whom I am married, said, well, what about, have you ever thought about something, someone like Dear Abby and Ann Landers, who were identical twins,
right,
and both had advice columns and had a huge feud for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And so that seemed like a great idea.
Yeah.
So I started writing that book, and it was set in my mother's era, basically, in their era. And it was going really, really, really badly. And I was terrified of writing about twins, and I couldn't get at them as twins. I didn't understand them, and I didn't like them, and I didn't like the whole idea. So this is how my books come to be, which is just rejection of every idea you work on for a year.
Sure.
And then Janet gave me a little book called English as She Is Spoke, which was a sensation in the 19th century. It's meant to be a phrase book for Portuguese people traveling in English-speaking countries. The only problem is the person who wrote it, whoever he or she was, could not speak English. So, and people loved it. It was like a comic sensation, and it was the equivalent of going viral. And Mark Twain wrote an introduction to it and loved it. And so here's one of the phrases that the book teaches
you.
Okay. The stone as roll, not heap up, not foam.
It's like almost Yoda.
So I believe that's meant to be a rolling stone gathers no moss.
Sure.
Another one was a horse bored, don't look him in the tooth. I don't know exactly what that is, but
bored,
B-O-A-R.
Oh, see, I was thinking of a horse who was just
Like bored, but who knows, because this person couldn't spell
right,
either.
Right.
So anyway, this I she gave me this book to cheer me up because Trump had been elected president, so mm-hmm. I was completely paralyzed in terms of writing for many, 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 many months. And B, it was going nowhere. And I read that and I thought, oh, well, I'm going to do this about something I really love, which is words and dictionaries and my little hobby passion. And then once I knew that and I started writing about these twins, they actually came to life mm-hmm. as people, not as these very unpleasant twins that I didn't understand.
Right.
So that's how I got to twins.
Wow.
Yes.
And so we meet Laurel and Daphne, but we also are introduced to in every chapter. We have a definition of a word throughout the book. And I love it. One of my favorites is bookish.
Yes.
Which I feel like maybe has made a comeback in the past decade or so, because in the book it says usually used contemptuously.
Well, partly I think this was Samuel Johnson making a joke.
I'm glad. Okay.
But I'm not sure. I mean, I think maybe he was saying people are, you know, use it contemptuously. He also made it, he wrote about his definition of lexicographer, which is what he was.
Yes.
Was very dismissive also. So,
okay.
So, but yeah, it really struck me as something funny and true in some ways to some people.
And
Laurel, just not us.
and Laurel and Daphne both love words and language. And
yeah, I started reading about twins and reading about some and who people, even people who aren't twins but are very, very close mm-hmm. in age, sometimes have a secret language, when they're really little. And I don't know if you've ever seen that YouTube of the two babies standing in front of the refrigerator going,
of course.
Yes. So so that I found very intriguing. And I wrote these two have a language as babies.
Yes.
And that was really fun to write. But then I had to stop myself at a certain point because I thought, oh, my God, what is this going to be like, that Bruce Willis movie where he's the voice of the baby? I forget what it's called.
Look Who's Talking.
Look Who's Talking.
But I was fascinated by, you do a work of translation in this book, because there's the goo goo gaga that they're doing, which is very specifically yours and theirs. Like, it's not the kind of thing we hear from all the YouTube babies we're familiar with now.
No. And I did try. Initially, I thought, oh, I'm going to invent a language. Ha ha. That's that. Since I only speak English, why not invent an entirely new one? That proved to be rather difficult. There are many rules to every language and phonetic rules. And but I did. I stole a little bit from the Mitford sisters, who mm-hmm. had a secret language that the younger sisters, I think, spoke to each other. So I stole some of their. I think it was called Bood. You know, I'm going to get it mixed up with Mayor Pete, because it sounded very much like Buttigieg. I think it was
That does sound like a word the Mitford sisters might say to each other.
Right, right.
But then also your translation of those nonsense words are just so funny.
Well, good. I'm really glad. They also, the girls also love words in the dictionary, you know, real words. And I just had this vision of them playing with the words, not word games as we think of them, mm-hmm. which I think are fascinating, but I'm really bad at them. So it's just not I can't do crossword puzzles or anything like that. But so I just imagined them as if the words were what they are, like, you know, like a little toy soldier or a little toy truck or a doll, but these are little words, and them playing these imaginary games with them. And that was fun to fool around with.
Are there any words that a particular twin liked that maybe was a part of their character development? Like,
one of the words when I was doing this, one of the words I became completely enamored of and fascinated with was the word other, because, you know, someone would say to one of the twins, they would say, I'm the other one. Mm-hmm. No, you're the other one. And the word other is so complicated. It's it is so many parts of speech. It has all these different meanings. So that one was sort of in the book, took a deep dive into other.
Right.
I think there's another part where one of them is trying to write about fashionable words, words that are fashionable, and suddenly realizes, because after all, it is the early 1980s, realizes that all fashionable words are about food.
Yes.
And when I was researching that, which was really fun, I had to like call all these people who had been food writers or, right. You know, and say what was, it's very hard to imagine now how exciting certain foods were at that time because now they're so ordinary.
Right.
So I was, you know, busy finding all kinds of, I mean, just even, I don't know, escarole was, yeah, that's... you know, or raspberry vinegar was a huge thing and everyone was talking about it. So I wouldn't identify a single word with either of the girls, but their interest eventually diverges,
yes,
in language. So yes, that is more what distinguishes them, I think, than particular words.
I didn't know that you didn't have any twins in your life.
Yes.
This is where I reveal that my older brothers are twins.
Yeah, it's so cool. I don't know why it's so cool, but it is really cool.
It's certainly interesting to observe because these are two people who don't have an identity really outside of the idea that they are two people who are together.
Yeah.
And more so than a husband and wife, more so than a mother and daughter, or any close relationship.
Does that bother them? Do they ever try to break out of that and say, "Hey, I'm an individual. I'm different from."
So here's what happened.
Yeah.
Of course they tried.
Of course.
And you know, all of the cliches are true. They're each other's best friends and worst enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that in the Grammarians, of course.
Right.
And
I'm glad I got that right.
It's absolutely true. They know how to push each other's buttons in a way that no one else is able. Like it's wild.
Yeah.
And for a long time, they wanted to go separate ways. And they moved to different cities and started doing different things. And now they are both police officers. Jewish police officers. Twins.
Jewish twin police officers. Are they in the same city?
No.
Okay.
They still live apart,
okay,
which I think actually cuts back on a little of the tension.
Yeah. Yeah.
Much like how Laurel and Daphne live in different parts of New York City.
Right.
Even.
Right. Right. That's really, it's really interesting. I mean, I tried so hard to, as you always do with any character who's, you know, if you're writing a character who is not exactly my age,
mm-hmm,
and my temperament, you know, I have to imagine what it is for them to be in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought a lot about these twins in relation to each other and in relation to the larger world. And then when I... getting back to words, when I looked up the word twin, and it has two meanings. The first meaning is as a noun, where it means the same, two of the same.
Right.
And the second meaning is to sever. And I thought, oh, that really tells you a lot.
Indeed.
So sometimes words are a clue to getting into a character, and sometimes characters need certain words to get them where,
yes,
where you want them. But that was a good discovery. Looking things up in the dictionary was the best part of writing this book because it's like sanctioned procrastination. And you can just sit, and I love dictionaries, and I just sat and I looked and I thought, oh, that's a good word. Oh, that word has a good sound. Oh, I didn't know that meant that. And it was great. It was really fun.
And it was fun even to learn a little bit of what you learn from reading the book.
Yeah. Well, good.
Yeah.
So I just want to know, your brothers, I want to know their names.
Jay and Seth.
Oh, those are good names. They sort of go together, and yet they're
one
different.
One syllable.
Yeah? No? Ellen? I'm interested. I had a lot of trouble finding names for Daphne and Laurel. I went through a lot of sort of nicknames, the way that Dear Abby and Ann Landers right. had their nicknames, and finally realized it just, you know, once in a while an idea comes that doesn't get discarded, and realized that, oh, Daphne and Laurel, sort of the same goddess, minor yes. Greek goddess, yeah. and perfect. So,
and I love, because I've observed this too.
Yeah.
How their parents react to them, which is...
Oh, good.
Because in any other parent-child relationship, I would think, you feel automatically like you're the most important person in the world to them.
Right.
And, of course, that's not the case with twins.
Right. That was something... You know, some of this I read about when doing research about twins, but that was something... I didn't read about how parents felt about having twins, but it was something that I kind of discovered as I was writing the book. I thought, wait, they're so important to each other. How does their mother feel? Yeah. It must be very, very weird for her. Mm-hmm. And the father has a different relationship with them and feels less excluded. But the mother was a character who developed kind of late as I was writing and became more interesting to yeah. me as I yeah. went on. And by the end of the book, I think kind of, which I'm not going to really discuss, but yeah. but kind of became very important in terms of how she understands the twins and what their lives really are going to be. So
yeah.
I'm glad I got that right. You never
and
know.
And also that feeling of knowing that these two beings are going to be each other's best friends and or worst enemies forever.
Forever. Yeah. Yeah. When I finished writing the book, I suddenly thought, oh, I wonder if I wrote this whole book as a message to my sons, which is you better be friends. You better stay friends mm-hmm. when I'm dead or I'm going to come back and haunt you. But I don't think so. But a little bit.
Well, what was, have they read it? Have they?
No, they don't read. Well, one of them is reading it because he's actually going to interview me at Google where he works.
Wonderful.
He's a linguist. And so.
Of course he is.
Of course he is. Yeah. So, but no, in general, they don't read my books, which I think is wise mm-hmm. for all of us.
My brothers don't listen to the podcast, which is
hello, boys.
Tell me a little bit about writing Manhattan in the 70s.
Well, luckily or unluckily,
60s.
Some might say, I was in Manhattan
yeah.
In the 70s, and I used to come. I grew up in Westport, Connecticut, a suburb, and I used to come in all the time, which I find unbelievable, but it's true. I used to come in barefoot because I was a hippie.
Wow.
And I'd take the train in and I'd walk around New York City barefoot. That, when I think about it now, is teenagers are really bizarre people. But yeah, it was fun it was interesting and fun to go back and remember what it was like, you know, finding that fifth floor apartment,
yeah.
walk up with the cockroaches and the, you know, and
the East Village.
And the East Village when it was really grungy and a little scary and a lot scary and very druggy and yeah, one of the things I did was I looked at a lot of photographs on, you know, online mm-hmm. to and it really brings you back, you know, just in an instant. But I also I didn't live in the East Village. I lived in the Village. And I worked at the Village Voice. So, you know, there were
right.
a lot of good things to throw in there from the past.
And Daphne, of course, gets a job at a
yeah.
publication that may or may not be.
Yeah, it's not really the Village Voice, but although there are a few details that were definitely from the Village Voice. The I do believe that the receptionist left after one of the columnists punched him in the face because he said, I don't know, one jazz musician was more important than another. So he quit. So yeah, there were certain things that I used that were real, but no, mostly it's all sort of made up. There were a few really, I mean, the Soho Weekly News had just started. There right. were some good, really good journalism going on down there.
And so you worked backwards in terms of this idea of there would be a conflict around language.
Mm-hmm.
How do you start then having Laurel and Daphne diverge into what their beliefs will be?
Well, I had always, from the time I knew about, I was a copy editor for a while,
right.
not a very good one. But because I can't spell, which is a problem. But I did it and I learned. And the more I learned because of that, the more every time I learned like the difference between which and that, I felt more and more superior to the rest of the world.
Right.
And then once you learn those distinctions, you start noticing them and you start looking down on the people who use them incorrectly, mm-hmm. which is, of course, absurd. So, but that's what I did, and I felt very strongly about it. And then I started talking to my son, Tommy, who explained to me, you know, that this really was a kind of social construct and that... Yeah. And then I started reading. I'm very interested in this, so I read a lot of blogs and Language Log is a wonderful thing that comes out of the University of Pennsylvania, and they're really great, smart linguists on it, and they're very funny. And so I started understanding that this was actually just a fashion or like manners. It was exactly the same as table manners. Not exactly, but close
right.
enough, like table manners. And that your table manners are different when you're sitting on the couch, you know, shoveling Chinese food from the
right.
from the container into
yes.
your mouth, or when you're at a someone's celebration for something and you're at a wonderful restaurant and you're eating properly. At least you hope
right.
that's true. Now, you
yes.
see there, I just avoided using hopefully, even though it's the perfect word.
Right.
But because I was indoctrinated that you shouldn't use it, I still have trouble using it, even though I know it's really an important, good word. So these things die hard. And there were many arguments in my household about all of this. And then I learned about code switching
mm-hmm.
and all that kind of stuff. And I learned about descriptivism and prescriptivism.
Yes.
And prescriptivism is pretty unfashionable among linguists, but it's quite fashionable among copy editors and
right.
People who write about grammar and try to, you know, scold people about their grammar. And I do think it's very, very important to edit and to look at language and make it beautiful and make it work and be
right.
to know what it is you're using or not using and not just ignorantly, you know, just blabbing.
Sure.
So I realized that this was the thing that was going to split them up. And it's partly having to do with their temperaments. And one of them winds up writing poetry eventually.
Yes.
And the other becomes a pretty established language columnist telling people what to do.
Yes.
And I think they both have their roles. And it can be pretty extreme on either end of the prescriptivist descriptivist divide, but I'm, you know, I'm sort of open to all discussion about language, so it was interesting for me. And people often have been asking me, oh, are you a Laurel or a Daphne? So first of all, I'm thrilled that they have personalities that where you
yes.
can ask that
yes
and they aren't just indistinguishable. But of course, I'm neither and both. I wish I knew as much as they do because, you know, your characters right. get to know much more than you do. But I also am not as a doctrinaire about either position.
But it works wonderfully as a plot device because, of course, yes, twins will be on the extremely different side of a very, very specific issue that
That's
they both have to be experts.
Right, right. That's and it's in some ways it's the same.
Yes,
it's got to be the same issue, but they both are still completely enamored of and obsessed with words, but they have to define themselves by going in completely different directions, which then turns them almost into enemies mm-hmm. or rivals, certainly.
Yes. Tell me quickly
yes.
about the decision, Laurel's decision in particular, to be a mom and about her identity in that regard.
Mm-hmm. When in my day, eons ago, 1912. No, in my day, that was, and it just, damn it, it still is
yes.
an issue. And I suppose it will be for a long time until there's childcare and
yes.
things like that in this country. But it was a big decision to make. Were you going to work and have children or just have children if you could possibly afford it? And I felt that she could afford it, and it was something she would want to do, to be there with this little person,
mm-hmm.
particularly as this little person learned to speak and to
yes.
to understand the world using words and through words. And but her sister, you know, is very dismissive of this decision and thinks it's pathetic. And
yeah.
and thinks that you just keep on working. Now, both of them are quite privileged and entitled.
Right.
And they both can work at home. They both have husbands who earn a living.
Yes.
So that, you know, that changes
the dream.
Yes. Yes. That changes the equation quite a bit. But within that context, that's they both go in these different directions, which I think are both valid and interesting and difficult choices that women, of course, have to keep making.
Yes. Tell me a little bit about what you've been reading. You did this amazing New York Times by the book. I think it was like one of my favorite ones. And so I don't want you to have to repeat anything. We'll put it in the show notes. But
okay.
what else are you into now?
Well, I've been reading a lot about Alma Mahler because I'm writing something about her, and that has taken up my entire summer and has been and fall and has been absolutely delightful and shocking. It's so wonderful when you read about an earlier period in history
right.
and realize they were so much more shocking and and weird than we are. And I just started a book last night by William Trevor, but because it was last night, I can't remember the title of it because I just started it and
yeah.
started, and it's wonderful. It's set in Ireland, and he's William Trevor's kind of beyond
yes.
amazing. So
beyond.
that is what I'm reading right now.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yay. Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.